series this past Sunday that I'm not quite sure I was ready for. Thought it would be exciting and fun and challenging and hopefully enlightening. And along the way, this past week came countless surprises, not all of which are resolved. And yet I want to read a sentence that I crafted in preparation for my sermon this morning. It's the belief that God has a preference for pulling off surprises. And sometimes that means he lets you see things in a desperate situation. So so near the edge of disaster and failure and complete ruin. And then he comes through. I shared last week a definition for you that I think is a apt description of God. It's a definition I found in Carta, a dictionary online. But maybe you remember these words. I certainly won't forget them. Surprised means to be feeling something of wonder and astonishment and amazement over something completely unanticipated. It's nothing less than knowing that the car you're driving is about to go off a cliff and by all means should do so, and you will end up dead at the bottom of the canyon, only to have God intervene. And it leaves you feeling all the above, wonder, astonishment, amazement, because you completely had no way of anticipating what God was doing or about to pull off. My belief is not shaken, but I need God to do that. And maybe you do too this morning. My belief is that God is that kind of God. And I don't think that's just a personal opinion. How else can you possibly read these words from the Apostle Paul, who said that, think of your senses, your eyes, they can't see it. No one's ears have heard. Not a single mind has imagined or conceived what God has in store for those that love him. Folks, that means God's not terribly predictable. You can't see it. You can't hear it coming. You can't know about it, no matter how much of God's word you read. God reserves the right to surprise. And I believe that Paul, the one that God gave these words to write for us in 1 Corinthians, I believe that he was reaching when he wrote for those words into the vault of his memory. In his day, he had the Old Testament to draw from, but when he did so, he looked back in time, and almost certainly, his memory took him back to the events that unfolded in Exodus chapter 12. The great deliverance of the living God. I'd like to ask you to turn your Bibles open to that passage of his word this morning. Page 48 is where you'll find the story that I think is entirely possible what Paul had in mind when he said, you can't imagine what God has in store. You can't begin to prepare yourself for all that God has in mind by way of surprise. The people are prisoners. They are captive to a foreign Pharaoh to an evil dictator that couldn't care less about them. They were there to serve his purposes, and that's all. And God says, I'm going to do something great that you can't do for yourself and have not been able to do for yourself for more than 400 years. You've been stuck. I'm going to pull it off, and I'm going to take you from all that misery into a land that he describes flowing with milk and honey. A beautiful, wonderful land of plenty. I want you to listen again to how this story comes down. After 9 plagues are carried out against their captors, God implements a 10th and final plague where he pours out upon the Egyptians, both animal and human, the death of the firstborn males. It is complete devastation in the land. And it happened under the cover of darkness. Chapter 12 tells us how it happened. Verse 29, at midnight the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was understandably a horrible cry, loud wailing in Egypt. For there was not a house without someone dead. Let that sink in. It's just gargantuan. Imagine our state waking up tomorrow morning and the firstborn male is dead in every single household. You start to read those words a little different, don't you? Loud wailing, probably heard in foreign lands, it was so great. During the night, Pharaoh, still at nighttime, summoned Moses and Aaron, seeing and beginning to sense the magnitude of what just took place. Says, up, leave my people, you, go, get away, leave, go worship the Lord as you've requested. Take your flocks, your herds, as you've said, go. Just throw a bone my direction is what he means next. Bless me as you leave. This is horrible. The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, sensing the disaster and calamity that had come upon them was only growing in size. They feared that they will all, in fact, end up dying. Verse 34, the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it over their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. They just grabbed what they had and went. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold for clothing. And the Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed at this point toward his people. So they gave them what they had asked for, and so they plundered them, these Egyptians. The Israelites journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, along with the women and children totaling somewhere between 2 and 3 million people exiting that night. Many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock and flocks and herds. With the dough they had brought from Egypt, they baked cakes of unleavened bread. The dough was without yeast because they were in a hurry. They were driven out and did not have time to prepare the food for themselves. That's how it unfolded. And that was a night of great deliverance. That's where this book we just read from, this book of Exodus, gets its name. The Exodus of God's people from Egypt en route to the promised land, flowing with milk and honey. That night, there was a celebration instituted and established by God called the Passover meal. And it was implemented as an annual meal to remember what God did. Look across at chapter 13 and you'll see how he explains this meal. Verse 10. You must keep this ordinance. Let's back up. Verse 8. On that day, tell your son, I do this meal because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. This observance will be for you like a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead. It'll be that familiar to you. Look at your hand. Pretend you're at the mirror this morning as you prepared to come to church looking at the forehead. It's a familiar thing he wants it to be in their minds and on their hearts. What is that? That the law of the Lord is to be on your lips, for the Lord brought you out of Egypt with his mighty hand. You must keep this ordinance at the appointed time, year after year. Drop down to verse 14. In days to come, years to come, when your sons ask you, what is this meal that we're taking part in and why is it such a big deal? Say to him, with a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. This is where I want to dig in this morning and draw out some principles related to how God surprises his people. Remember those words, eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, nor has mind conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. God's deliverance came as a big surprise. I'll bet these people could say to those words that I just showed you earlier from 1 Corinthians 2:9, I'll bet they could say, tell me about it. That's the truth. And I'm going to ask you a question this morning. Can you say that? When's the last time God blew you away? Where you were just cruising along and autopilot maybe spiritually, you're just kind of doing it, going through the motions, not out in sinful left field, you're just kind of cruising along, and then God says, I've got a plan that's going to completely change the paradigm you're following. Maybe for you it's been a while. Have you had this kind of big Exodus-like event where this truth was visited upon your life or somebody in your family? I'm going to guess the numbers are few. Maybe I'm off. Maybe I'm the only guy who says, God, I want you to do this again. To help you with your answer, let's look closely this morning at this section. No less than three ways I see that God surprised his people in how he delivered them. I want to state it the way you see it on the screen. God's deliverance came as a big surprise. The first way was this. God saw the struggles of his people for 430 years. 430 years before he put a plan in motion to set his people free. I stopped at verse 39. Look back at verse 40 in chapter 12. Now the length of the time the Israelite people lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of the 430 years to that very day, the Lord delivered his people, caused the divisions of the Lord to leave the land of Egypt, because the Lord kept vigil that night to bring them out of Egypt. On this night, all the Israelites are to keep vigil to honor the Lord for the generations to come. Folks, that's a long time to wait. It's a terribly long wait. No wonder the people are surprised. Truly and totally unanticipated. They went to bed that night. They were tired from work that day and did what everybody does at night. Put their head on a pillow. Probably not much of a pillow for these Israelites. And moaned their way once again to sleep. And then it happened. 430 years they've been waiting for this to happen. Hold your finger here and go back to the second chapter, Exodus. Same book, second chapter. Please look for this. Verse 23 of chapter 2. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went where? It went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. My point is, God heard and God saw the struggle of his people. Long years, decades, centuries before He implemented this plan that we're reading about in chapter 12. For reasons that are not all too obvious, he waits. And that leads us to the first of three takeaway truths that you and I can live by today. I would state it this way. Takeaway truth number one. Sometimes God's ways are slow by our standards, but they're still the best. Trust them anyway. How many, raise your hand if you're tired of God being in such a hurry. I've never asked anybody that. Hey, you know, are you just, is it breakneck speed, you know the expression? Are you just knocked over constantly? Almost always the answer is just the opposite. I would love to see God move in my situation. Maybe you wait for God right now to save a spouse of yours. You've been living with someone that doesn't know Jesus for a long time, and you've stayed faithful to that marriage. And you have prayed, probably privately. They're not terribly interested in you praying for them in their presence. But you stay at it. Maybe it's not a spouse. Maybe it's a child. Perhaps for you, it's a rebellious child that you have longed to see them come back, like Luke 15 talks about. Maybe you can point to a financial. Yours is a financial trouble that could be fixed like that. It really could be. God could deliver a check in the mail to you tomorrow when the mail comes. And presto. And you can complain, wow, that happened so fast, God. Can you slow down next time? I doubt he's going to hear too many complaining prayers that way. Right? But your wait continues, doesn't it? It was true for the Hebrews, and it matches our experience too. Sometimes God's ways are slow by the way we see things. But listen to me. Plug in every ounce of faith you've got in this statement. They are always the best. If you and I can't take that to the bank, we don't have much. They may be slow by our standards, but they're always the best. So ours is to trust them anyway. God said through the prophet Isaiah, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways," declares the Lord. There's enough proof already. As the heavens are higher than the earth, that's incalculable. So are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. Give God credit for being wiser than you and me. Trust him in his ways. Second way this morning, God's deliverance came as a surprise. I'd state it this way. It's on your outline as well. God knew the most direct route to take his people, but he chose another way. I'm going to show you a slide of the area where all this took place. God knew that the most direct route, this is where they are. It's Ramesses, known by different names today, but it's Ramesses. This is northern Egypt. And God says, I'm going to lead you out from that land to the land over here, Jerusalem, center place in the land, as I referred to earlier, flowing with milk and honey. Now, if I handed this pointer to every single person in this place, we would have a lot of fun this morning, wouldn't we? But you all, and I said simply, would you draw a line of the most direct route to take your people, or to let's say you're going on vacation, and you're in Egypt, in Ramesses, and you want to go to Jerusalem. And I handed this pointer to everybody in this place and said, tell us the most direct route because you want to get there. How many would go something like this? Show me your hands. Okay? I would too. But God had another plan. A slightly different route. Can you see the route God took? Whoa, not quite there. Hey, let's come back. Does that leave you thinking and scratching your head saying, what is the deal, God? Where are we going? God plans to lead his people to a land of plenty, from a land of poverty. The most direct route, 300 miles, by the way. That's all that is, 300 miles. You can get there pretty quick, even with 2 million people. Just keep walking. But not the route God chose to take them. And he had his reasons, as you might suppose. In this case, not in every case, listen to me now, not in every case, but in this case, he tells us. Look back at chapter 13 and you'll see, verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, watch this now. God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. I'll say. For God said if they face war, they might change their mind and retreat to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. And the Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. God took a down and around route because he saw what was unseen. And he still does. He sees and knows about obstacles and challenges that are hidden even in your route. In their case, what were those obstacles and challenges? Philistines. Lots of Philistines. A bunch of them. And it might cause his people to retreat and go back defeated. Here's the takeaway truth this morning related to this principle. When God takes you the long way, when God takes you the long way or the slow way, I think we're stuck on a slide here. My pointer's having so much fun this morning that, there we go. When God takes you the long way or the slow way or the inconvenient way, go willingly because he knows the best way. Folks, I got to tell you something. That's hard to do because we live in a MapQuest world. We do. We pride ourselves in knowing where we're going and how we'll get there. God says, walk with me. And I know the way, and I know what's on the way. So plan your way, but let me direct your steps. In fact, I'll go so far as to say today, if you don't have a plan that tells people you know where you're going and how to get there, they look at you as a lousy planner. People insult you and say things like, you don't know what you're doing, do you? When the reality is, you could say rather meekly and dead on biblically, I'm letting God lead the way. I'm letting him lead the way. No, it doesn't rise to your right brain or left brain need to know exactly what I'm doing. That's okay. God will lead the way. Proverbs 16:9 is a favorite. In his heart, man plans his course. But the Lord, circle the word but, the Lord determines his steps. The mind of man does plan his way. Go ahead and make plans. But by all means, every chance you get, remind yourself, but the Lord directs my steps. Now for a final way, God surprised his people and how he delivered him. It's really the biggest I've saved for the last. Third way, God knew the logistics of getting 600,000 men with their wives and children across the sea to safety. He knew those logistics. Food, water, a wide enough stretch of land to go. You're talking lots and lots and lots of people. Put it in perspective, the entire state of Oregon trying to go together and move in a single direction. It's a logistical nightmare. I mean, you know, we fill a rose garden with 20,000 people, and it takes ushers and attendants and police and traffic people. You know, you've been to a Blazer game or something. You know, a concert. It's a big, big deal. God knew all those logistics, but he led them still directly to the shore to show them his glory. Look at chapter 14. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Bel Zephon. Pharaoh will think, they're confused. They're wandering around in the land all messed up, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and he will pursue them, but I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh." It's your Bible, underline that. Don't miss that. "I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites, they did this. The stage is set, folks. God was delivering his people. They made a peaceful exit. All was good. Happily ever after, right? Let's just walk into the new land. Not so fast. Why? What was missing was a pursuing army. Madder than a hornet. That adds the drama that God required to pull off the biggest surprise that Israelites, Jewish people today still talk about. Christians too. Let me show you what I mean. Read on verse 5. "When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, 'What have we done? We've let the Israelites go and we've lost all this free labor, their services.' So he had his chariots made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there they were. There was no mistaking it. There weren't a few of them. They were coming after them with a vengeance, marching after them, and it caused the Israelites to be terrified and cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, 'What's the deal? What, were there not enough graves back in Egypt to bury us, so you brought us out here in the desert to finish us off? What are you up to? What's this all about? What have we done? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, "Leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians"? It would have been better for us to be slaves there serving the Egyptians than to be here dying in the desert." The stage is hugely set. And folks, by the way, you would panic too, and so would I. I let myself be in that crowd this week. You've come all this way. You keep looking over, no sign of them, and then suddenly your hoofbeats. And at the same time you hear this approaching army, guess what you're staring at in Pi Hahiroth? That's right on the shore of this ginormous body of water. You're in a panic. You are standing there, and there is absolutely, you know it, there is no way around this body of water, this Red Sea. It's 1,450 miles long. It is 150 miles wide in most places on average. There is no way to go around it. There is absolutely, it's inconceivable to go under it. Forget building a bridge over it. But folks, God had another way. God had another way. A God-sized, for you English people, preposition. You can't go around it. That didn't work. You can't go under it. Lousy preposition. You can't go over it. That won't work either. You got to go through it. Verse 15 tells us, the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground." Take away truth time, folks. God pulls off big plans to achieve multiple outcomes that are bigger than you. In this story alone, I see several. God's glory. That's why I stopped to punctuate verse 4, chapter 14. God's glory is a big deal. Verse 13 is about God's deliverance. Verse 28, we didn't get there, but it reads about God's destruction of his enemies. That was another objective accomplished by this great deliverance. And then turn the page. You got to see the last verse. Verse 31, when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in his Moses, in his servant Moses. Dedication of God's people came as a result of God's deliverance. Folks, our view is too small if we look for in a movement of the hand of God something that serves just our purposes. God is too wise to waste a big deliverance. So he pulls off multiple outcomes. His glory, the deliverance of his people, the destruction of their enemies, and the most important one, the allegiance of his people to him. So my question to you this morning, does your situation look impossible? The enemy's closing in. I don't know what it's, bill collectors, I don't know what it is. Pick your enemy today. It's a health report that doesn't give you any way out. And you're in a pinch. I remember the first time I heard some words from Chuck Swindoll. It was over lunch when I was resigning as a pastor at the church because we had been infertile and then suffered a great loss in a miscarriage. And it wrecked me. It nearly ruined my faith. And it was at that lunch that he said to me words that changed everything. They changed everything. He looked at my situation and said, we are all faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised by God as impossible situations. I don't know where that fits you right now, but I'm certain it does. I'm certain this message is for way more people than me. Faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as impossible situations. So was our situation. So were the Israelites, and so are many of you. But God still surprises his people. God still delivers his people. God still gets glory. Only one question left to ask. It's the question that I had you read that last verse for. Have you put your fear and faith in God? That moves up to you. I'd like you to bow your heads if you would, please. You are the great I am, Lord. And we could answer every one of us honestly, and we are not. You have brought into our lives, many of us, even current, a series of great opportunities. To even admit that, to even say those words is a statement of faith. We don't see them that way right now. They're brilliantly, currently, completely concealed and disguised as impossible situations. If you're facing one of those right now, I want to ask you to look up at me this very moment because I'm going to pray in a moment. I see heads everywhere. I knew this was for more than me. Okay. I'm going to ask you to stand right now to your feet. If you looked up at me, I'd like you to start by standing right now. Just stand from your seat. And that's a first step of faith, to say, God, I'm going to look at my situation differently today. Starting right now, I want you to get the glory. And by standing, I am choosing to put my faith and my fear in you. So God, we come to you right now. As people who face all kinds of impossibilities, but we come to you believing that, God, you're going to get great outcomes and gain. It may not be a resolved situation later today or this week or anytime soon. God, may today be a paradigm change for us who are standing before you right now. But we start to look at problems and concerns and difficulties as great opportunities to see your glory. Because you are holy and you are full of glory. Help us to see and experience that as we walk by faith and as we this moment give to you those situations for which we stand. In the name of Jesus Christ, I pray. Will the rest of us join these who are standing now as we sing a final song, collect the morning offering, and request for prayer.